let's go further back. I mean, countries like Nicaragua and Cuba, and indeed Bolivia more recently, have been very supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Well, they certainly set the standard, I think, for the rest of the world, in my opinion. But anyway, we asked Pablo about Chile's bond with Palestine and how deep it actually runs.
OK, so I'm the son of Chilean political refugees. I'm born and raised in the UK. Now, Chile is the country that has the biggest Palestinian population outside the Arab world. And there are between 300,000 to 500,000 Palestinians, is estimated. And take into account that Chile has just under 20 million people. So it's not an insignificant population. Now, the roots of this population date back to the late 1800s, Christian enclaves around Bethlehem, Palestinians that left for Latin America. But principally, the population in Chile came after the First World War, again, Christian predominantly, that settled in Chile. And initially, it was a kind of more secular, progressively orientated in terms of politics population. But as it has embedded itself, many have done very well with business, and this population has become, in terms of at least of the representation, which is estimated to be about 6,000 Palestinians that form a kind of body, a Palestinian body that represent the community, which is, again, not much, 6,000 out of potentially 500,000. But this representative body is more conservative, has close ties to Chile's elite. So I think also interesting to think about is expressions of concrete solidarity with Chile. And here, I think it's worth mentioning the Palestinian Football Club of Chile's first division that was created in the 1920s and has, you know, if you go today to the stadium, you will see Palestinian flags, one of the only places where you'll see the Palestinian flag waved freely. And, you know, chants of Gaza resists, Palestine exists.
David, Latifa referred to the legendary Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez in her report. I mean, just tell us what his stance was on Israel.
Well, Chavez was an uncompromising advocate to the Palestinian cause. I think one of the things you've got to remember here is that the scepticism that there is on the left in Europe and parts of the world towards Islamic revolution is not held so strongly in Latin America. They come from a Christian background, predominantly Catholic, yes, but they're much more able to understand that religion can play a role in revolution than is the left in Western Europe, I think. And that's partly because of the role of the Christianity in the liberation struggles in Latin America. So we see a much easier connection between Palestinian liberation and the liberation movements of Latin America. And that's something which Chavez, socialist that he was, understood very well.
Indeed. Well, I also asked Pablo to outline the attitude of the new Chilean government about Palestine.
In December 2021, a former student leader turned lawmaker, Gabriel Boric, won the Chilean presidential election. And he won it against a far-right politician who was the son of a Nazi army officer. Cast was the surname, and someone that openly had said he still admired the fascist US-backed dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that ruled between 1973 and 1990. So Gabriel Boric is someone that, as a lawmaker, has effectively supported levels of BDS, has come out denouncing Israel in the past. And his government, since March 2022, I was in Chile when he became president, has made a number of symbolic gestures, which I think are important, but perhaps shouldn't be overstated. There was there were credentials for the new Israeli ambassador that were essentially postponed in September after the latest killings by the Israeli government of Palestinians. But that, again, much was made of that. But 2 weeks later, Boric, the government, apologized and did accept the credentials.
David, what do we know about the links between Venezuela and Hezbollah, which, of course, as we know, has been proscribed in this country?
So the Venezuelans have been very supportive of Hezbollah, as they have of the Palestinians. And both Maduro and Chavez have said, you know, we will not be abandoning our allies. And these are people who they regard as comrades in arms and not as as terrorists or as Islamic fundamentalists, as many people on the left in Western Europe would say.
I mean, Latifa also referred to a character known as Carlos the Jackal. What do we know about him? I remember there's quite a bit of publicity about him about 30 years ago.
So Carlos was one of these sort of fictional terrorists for the Western media, someone who's so bad that even the mention of his name was enough to get to the front page of the tabloid press. Now, of course, he was a Palestinian guerrilla, and you know, unlike many people in Western Europe, the people in Latin America who support Palestinian liberation weren't willing to just throw people under the bus because they were engaged in armed struggle. So that's the key thing. There's an unflinching ability to say, no, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
It's curious, isn't it? Because as I mentioned, there was lots of publicity, I remember, at the time. I mean, why do you think it is that the Western media sort of focus on a character like Carlos the Jackal?
Well, they have to create the idea that there are these individuals who are motivated by some kind of personal animus or by some kind of religious drive, and that these are people who are in some way mad. That's what the whole idea of terrorism really is that these people are committing terror against civilians, they will say, and they're not engaged in struggle against military forces. And that the problem with these people is not just that they have a belief and they're fighting in relation to what they regard as justice, but they are somehow mad, right? And that's the idea. That's why you have Carlos the Jackal. You have this name to indicate he's kind of like a serial killer. Like that's the way they want to make it. These are people who are mad and bad, and not people who are motivated by a political motivation, which of course was the reality.
No, indeed. And of course, another legendary Latin American figure, Fidel Castro, of course, someone else who I think has stood out and in solidarity, you know, with revolutionary struggles in Palestine.
That's right, in Palestine and indeed in other places. I remember she, of course, travelled to Africa to support revolution there.
Che Guevara, of course. Right, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm just going to pause the conversation there now for a moment because we've got another quite shocking report, actually, about the relationship between the previous far-right president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the Israeli regime.
Many have questioned who the most pro-Israel Latin American leader has been. The winner of that dubious competition may well be former Brazilian president and military officer Jair Bolsonaro. It is believed that his emotional promotion of the Zionist project stems from his aim to ingratiate himself with his Christian evangelical electoral base. But Bolsonaro has gone over and above his servility to Israel. At Palestine Declassified, we question if Bolsonaro has facilitated the penetration of Brazil's armed forces by Israeli intelligence. Benjamin Netanyahu was the first Israeli political leader to visit Brazil following the election of Bolsonaro. He proudly hosted Netanyahu at a synagogue in Rio de Janeiro, where they announced a brotherhood between their countries with the intent of increasing economic, military, and technological integration. Bolsonaro bestowed upon Netanyahu the highest national honor for visiting political figures, and the Brazilian post office released a special stamp to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Zionist entity, featuring a picture of Netanyahu next to the word Savior in Hebrew. Bolsonaro was in turn crowned with a Friends of Zion Award in occupied Al-Quds. The family bonds between the Bolsonaros and Israel are so strong that the former Brazilian president's sons have been pictured wearing IDF t-shirts, and his wife even delivered her vote in the most recent election wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the Israeli flag. The most sinister part of this story is Bolsonaro's role in submitting the data of the Brazilian army to an Israeli cybersecurity company with an umbilical relationship to Israeli intelligence. In March 2022, the Israeli company CySource signed an agreement to train the Brazilian military in cyber defense. The CEO and founder of the company is Amir Barel, who is reported to have worked for Israel's external intelligence service, Mossad, before entering the private sector. He also previously worked with the Israeli spy company NSO Group, which developed the Pegasus software that has hacked the phones of journalists, human rights defenders, and politicians around the world. Cysource is also part of the Israeli cyber companies consortium, led by the arms company Israel Aerospace Industries. The consortium was founded in 2016 by Israel's Ministry of the Economy to, quote-unquote, provide an overarching solution by Israeli cyber companies to the needs of different national-level cyber agencies. In addition to granting this deal to Cysource, a Brazilian lieutenant from the military, Luiz Katsa, was appointed as the global sales director of the Israeli company. How can the Brazilian military protect its sovereignty from Israeli espionage?
David, would you say that Bolsonaro takes the award as the most pro-Israel Latin American leader probably in history?
Possibly in history. I mean, he is clearly very strongly pro-Israel. And you saw that his son's there with the IDF T-shirts and the Mossad T-shirts you can buy in Israeli airports as you travel into the country. I'm not sure if they sell them to just everyone, but they are certainly available. And but let's think back in history. I mean, the Israelis have a strong record of intervening in Latin America. And back in the days when the military ran Argentina, there was a strong role there. The Israelis supplied weapons to the military dictatorship there, including in a period when the dictatorship was rounding up Jews. And the Israelis didn't balk at that. They still supplied the weapons. So there's been a long history of involvement. And, of course, what they're doing in Brazil now is trying to penetrate the Brazilian military to get the data. I mean, anyone who thinks that these cybersecurity companies are just there for business reasons hasn't thought for more than 2 minutes about it. I mean, this is a conscious effort by Israeli intelligence to branch out into the corporate world and to use the corporate results for Israeli intelligence's own benefit. So, you know, certainly Bolsonaro is a very strong pro-Israel character, but he's not the only one by any means.
Well, I asked Pablo what he could tell us about the farcical Venezuelan opposition figure, Juan Guaido, and his relationship with Israel.
Yeah, Juan Guaido was a far-right, again, politician, a sort of a bit of a nobody, really, in Venezuela, known by only 20% of the population when it was decided by the US and others that he would be the latest attempt to effect regime change in Venezuela, something they've been trying since 1999 when Hugo Chavez first came to power, and obviously under Chavez, you know, support for Palestine and Palestinians' resistance against the savagery of Israel and what it does daily in Palestine went up many notches, and obviously Israel viewed Venezuela under Chavez as a threat. And so Guaido was this, you know, self sort of pathetic figure, really, that decided that he'd call himself the president with the support of the UK and the US and other sort of imperial states. And even though now the opposition have discarded him, he's still someone that the UK, I think, recognises as the president. It's all sort of farcical and pathetic. But he, you know, when he declared himself president in February 2019, he said he would restore diplomatic relations with Israel immediately. Obviously, something that had been, you know, not been the case for 10 years prior under Chavez broke diplomatic relations. He said he would open an embassy. And so he was really kind of, you know, very much a puppet for U.S. imperialism, for what Israel is attempting also to do in the region. But really, he's just a sort of a washed out figure now that has no relevance, but, you know, continues to be, you know, thought of as some kind of president by people in London and in Washington.
David, what else can you tell us about Cysource that was mentioned in the last package about Bolsonaro?
So Cysource is a cyber defense company. We've seen on the show a number of different cyber defense companies and tech companies which have been, you know, rolled out of Israeli intelligence. And the plan clearly is, with all of these companies, is that you create these commercial vehicles, you staff them with ex-intelligence officers who then will have some kind of relationship with Mossad or even with Shin Bet internally in the Zionist entity. So if you look at it from the point of view of Mossad sitting in Tel Aviv, and they have all these different cyber defence companies and cybersecurity companies and tech firms. CISORS is one of them. There's many others we've looked at in this programme. What you see is the ability to try and penetrate the information infrastructure of different countries. In the UK, for example, we saw only the other week we did a show on Oracle, the Zionist firm in America, penetrating the Ministry of Defence in this country. And this is what CISORS is up to in Brazil. It's about penetrating the data, which allows them to penetrate into the fabric of the running of the Brazilian society. And that's what they're doing in all the countries in which they're engaged.
Mm. And, of course, Bolsonaro's a former military officer, isn't he? And I just wonder, do you think it's possible that he's opened his country up to Israeli espionage then?
Well, this is obviously what the Israelis are trying to do. They try and do it in the UK and the US, which are their notional allies, and of course they'll do the same in Brazil. If Brazil thinks it's just an ally and they're going to work together, well, no. I mean, they're going to be penetrated, and the Israelis will use that to their own advantage, either to project their own power in Latin America or to gain power against and subvert the Brazilian state itself. So, you know, we're now in a position where Lula is the new president of Brazil, you know, what's going to happen with those contracts? I mean, if Lula knew what he was doing, he would, of course, have cancelled these contracts and removed the Israelis straight away, but that hasn't happened yet.
No, indeed. Of course, the thing is, though, I mean, has Bolsonaro facilitated it, though? I mean,
Of course he has. I mean, once you get these contracts in place and you appoint Brazilian military people to the boards of the companies, you're fusing together Israeli foreign policy interests and the security interests of the security state in Brazil.
And finally, David, I mean, looking ahead, how do you think the Palestinian and Latin American relations will develop in the years ahead?
Well, I mean, you have to think about this in terms of how you think the revolution in Palestine is going to develop. And from my point of view, it looks like we're entering into a new intense phase of resistance in Palestine, with the possibility of the full liberation of Palestine within the next few years. Mm. And that will mean that there will be an increasing need for solidarity, but also an increasing desire to give solidarity, because what happens usually in these sort of scenarios, whether it's an anti-colonial revolution or an anti-settler colonial revolution, is that once the liberation movement comes closer to liberation, that the support rallies all around the world. And you saw that with South Africa, you saw that in relation to a number of other countries, Algeria. So what we'll see is, with Latin American countries, is especially those which are already supporting Palestine, that their support will intensify and it will be added to by other countries which will come on board.
Mm. Do you think it's significant that that solidarity is more pronounced in former, you know, countries that were former, you know, subject to, you know, colonisation by Western powers?
I don't think it's just that they were subject to colonisation, but it's that they have their own immediate history of having to win their freedom through armed struggle. And that's the key clincher, isn't it? People understand that you've got to fight, you know, if you're going to overthrow military dictatorships. And people in Western Europe don't really have that history. Mm. Not in the last 50 years.
No,
whereas people in other parts of the world do have that history.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid the clock's beaten us again today, so we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Pablo Navarrete, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you. Don't just leave it there. The stories and scrutiny that we provide are being suppressed by corporate media and big tech. So help us to beat the censorship by sharing today's programme on social media. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University, and we have had this pleasure to have him in the studio. We, in this program, discuss your problems, questions related to the Islamic upbringing and different topics which have a very great deal with the Islamic upbringing of children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his family, may peace be upon them. Well, Professor Naqvi, we have been discussing about love and obedience in the upbringing. I would just want you to give us the basics of the theme that we have today, and then we will go to the audience questions.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Basically, I think that it is important to understand that all our actions and our behavior with respect to each other, especially, and especially when we're about to raise children, we need to understand that this relationship has to be based upon love and affection. And it's not just loving people by having those emotions and feelings inside you. It's more about expressing those feelings in a proper way. But how does that come about? Because feelings have to translate into actions. But based on the worldview which we have, the ideology which we talk about and profess about, Islam and the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt al-Islam, the most prominent thing is the love of Allah Almighty, from which the love of all mankind should emanate. If we should know that Allah Almighty in the first place loves His creations, especially mankind, human beings. Basically, it's because of love that He has created everything. We believe that He has, number one, He is omniscient, He knows everything, His knowledge expands everything, and then His knowledge changes into His will based on the love of Himself and His creations. And then that changes into omnipotence. Not that it changes, it is the omnipotence and His overall power over the universe is extended because of that knowledge and that love that is in His very essence.
Okay.
And now, so basically the creation of the world is based on that love that He has.
Yeah.
And then He expects us to love Him. And He expects us to obey Him.
It's often said that the amount of love that a mother has towards a child, it's not just 0.11% of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has towards a human being. So how do we relate that, basically? How do we come to know about that?
Actually, the problem is which we need to resolve in our lives is that how can we manage the love that we have for our children, for us, for our close kinsmen and our family members and our each other? How can it be subsumed and brought under the umbrella of the love of Allah Almighty? That is the important thing.
All right.
Because
love everybody has, like each parent has love for his child. But you're saying the important thing over here is how that love gets reflected in that parent and how he is able to show that this love is the love of the ultimate God. Well, we'll discuss more on the topic. Let's go for a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Naqavi with us, and we are discussing our theme today in upbringing is love. And Professor Naqavi, you were saying that parents do love their children. All parents have different parents love their children differently. However, it's very important that this love should reflect the manifestation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly. As you said, everyone has love for his children or their children. Why? Because they are his or her offspring. They belong to him or her. Just in the same way that Allah loves us, because he has created us. He loves himself, therefore he loves his creations. In the same way, we have played a role in the birth of our children, so they belong to us in this sense, because we have become a part of the cause and effect system that Allah has created, through which our children come to this world. And so they belong to us, so we love them because they are ours. I don't love another person's child because he's not from me. That child is not from me. But the most important thing is that this chain has to be reflected, this chain of effect, cause and effect. The cause is Allah Almighty. He has created us, and through us he has created our children. So this love of Allah should be extended through our love to our children. Our love of our children should not be because they are our children, because they have been given to us by Allah Almighty. Therefore, the result would be that we do not expect them to obey us. We expect them to obey Him. So right. Obedience to Allah is the primary concern. That is the ultimate thing.
So
we need to train our children in such a way that they obey Allah Almighty and they love Allah Almighty.
So are you actually trying to say, like, we as parents, when we become kind to our children, and sometimes we have these questions kind of like, if you forgive your child for any damn mistake, he was expecting to get punished very severely. And then when you actually forgive your child, so are you trying to say when such children come up and they say, hey, mom, how come are you so forgiving? Or, hey, dad, how come are you so forgiving? Then this mother should give a reply kind of, because Allah is forgiving, because Allah is kind. So that's how I am kind. And I'm one of his, one of a very smallest, tiny, like, things in his object, in his creation.
Yes. So one of the aspects is this, that what you're saying, that when a child is being forgiven by his children, he feels that our parents are doing the right thing, they're doing a good thing. But they should also know,
they should relate it to the actual cause.
Exactly. The important thing is that a lot of people say, we should fear Allah Almighty. What is taqwa? Fearing Allah Almighty. To fear Allah, to have the fear of Allah Almighty. Whereas we should have the love of Allah Almighty in our hearts. Why do we say the fear of Allah Almighty?
Well,
is Allah something to be feared from?
Because if you are scared of something, then you how come you can love that personality? Love comes when you are very actually free and relaxed with someone, and then is when you that love comes in. Well, we'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing love as a main theme in Islamic upbringing. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you made us understand some very important concepts, that the actual cause of love in this world is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and its effect is reflected in its creation, like in that of parents and children love. So one of the important questions that we have reached right now is, how can we develop love for Allah and our children when at the same time we are telling them to fear Allah?
Exactly. So we need to understand ourselves that the fear of Allah Almighty is not something separate from the love of Allah Almighty. When we say that Allah Almighty becomes displeased, or we should fear Him because we would not like to offend Him, we should not make Him angry with us, He should not express His wrath upon us, He should not put us to punishments, give us punishments. Or, for example, there are earthquakes and natural calamities, disasters going on. And this is the expression of the wrath of Allah Almighty. He is ghadab. Then we say, look, no, but His ghadab is surpassed by His love and for His mercy. His mercy is much more than His ghadab and His wrath and His anger. Now, there are two ways of understanding this. We say love and anger are two parallel things, or we can say no, anger or displeasure is a result of the love that He has. He loves us and He wants us to become perfect people, good people, and because we stray from that path, when we deviate from that path, He dislikes the fact that we are deviating from the right path. So His love, His fear, His anger, His displeasure is also a result of His love. So in the same way, when we are angry with our children, it's because of our love for them. And they should realize that if my parents are becoming angry, it's not because they are they have personal emotions and feelings and they have been, you know, put off by my actions. No, they are concerned with my behavior. They are concerned with my becoming a good person. Mm-hmm. So therefore, just as Allah Almighty's anger is surpassed by His love and mercy, and actually the anger and the thing which we should fear is His displeasure, because we are deviating from the path that He has shown us. And actually, the anger is also a part of the love. It is due to the love that He has for us. In the same way, we have to bring up our children to make them realize that if we scold them, if we show them, show our displeasure with the actions, it's not because of their personal feelings. It's because of our
love and care.
Love and care that we want them to be on the right path. And we want them to be on the right path which Allah Almighty has shown, not the right path which we think.
Which we actually see as the right path. Well, here we have groups of people who get developed into two categories. Some who either are very obedient to Allah and some who become disobedient. How these, when they become adults, become two different kinds of personalities, sometimes even from the same families. We'll discuss this more under the same theme in upcoming episode. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our program again, please go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab COI Call of Islam and you'll find our programs there. Well, you can also search us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam. If you have any queries, any questions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Establishment of governments is not for profits as essential purpose. All their invitation is prelude to awakening of human being and making men understand what man has been, what he is, and what he will be, and that how the world is, and what relationship it has with the sacred essence of Allah Almighty. We have no access to such problem, and hope that thanks to the saints of the God, we can also gain, however, faint acquaintance and some of the veils are removed from our eyes.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to IRB English Radio and this program, Spring of the Truth, in which we are trying to have a look at some of the statements and viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, specifically in this series of shows about the Islamic government and Islamic country. Imam rahmatullah alayh in a statement says that tyranny governments are separate from their nations and they rule the nations and the nations are also separate from them. Actually, Imam's addressing the head of the governments and the statesmen that if you're after an Islamic government, that is not going to stay at the level of surface. So you have to be with people. You have not to be separate from the people, from the nation themselves. Imam tells them, if you look at the tyrant governments, they have no relationship with their own people. Yes, in order to make some show-offs, usually they make some gatherings and some, let's say, campaigns to prove that they are with people. But are they the realities of the society and are they in touch with all the layers and classes of the society? This is something that has to be questioned. So Imam wants all the leaders to be with the people and not separate from the people. And he tells them, if you are going to be separate from the people, look at the way that the arrogant and tyrant governments are doing. So if you want to be following the same line, you will not be able to implement an Islamic model where the views and voices of the people are very, very important and are valued. The same way that they have been valued at the time of the Holy Prophet. His governmental model in the government of Imam Ali alayhi salam and later on in Imam Hassan and the other infallibles and successors of the Holy Prophet. So people's views are valued and important, and the nation themselves and the nation in general should be valued and should be respected and should not be separate from the leaders of the government. As we said earlier, the leaders of the government and the statesmen are going to be from the lowest classes of the society. That is, their life and social affairs should be like ordinary and even lower classes of the society.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the geopolitical situation in West Asia with strategic analyst Sharmeen Narwani. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
The world is experiencing fundamental changes in the global power constellation. And as the geostrategically most important region in the world, West Asia is in the middle of these historic transformations. Like other regions in the world, it's experiencing major economic problems related to inflation and the combined aftereffects of the global COVID pandemic, US mismanagement of the global economy, and more than 20 years of a devastating global war by the US in the name of the so-called War on Terror. The world is only now coming to understand the profound significance of the historic defeat that the US and its allies experienced in West Asia in the early 21st century, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan, which some have suggested was a third world war by historic standards, and which effectively ended any claims of the US to global hegemony and began a reordering of global affairs by the victors. But who were the winners of this Third World War? The Islamic Republic of Iran, with its allies in the various resistance movements of the region, joined later by a resurgent Russia and a rising China, who are all now in the process of creating a new global order with its own institutions, independent of the West, for the first time in centuries. This is turning out to be a big test for many local elites in West Asia, who have staked their continued worldly power and existence on US and Western backing. And we are already witnessing their desperate efforts to quickly reorient themselves towards these new powers in order to save their illegitimate tribal and military dictatorships. What's clear to most observers is that West Asia will be very different at the end of the year 2023 than it is at the beginning of the year 2023.
Sharmeen Narwani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You are the editor-in-chief and columnist of the Cradle online magazine, which deals with, which focuses on the geopolitics of West Asia, and you recently launched the Arabic language edition. I'm very happy that we're able to do this conversation, have this conversation. I follow your publication, and there are a lot of excellent analysis and articles and news items in there. Always, a good place for people to go to if they want to know what's going on in West Asia. And so we're going to take this opportunity in this conversation to look at a more broad analysis of, make a more broad analysis of what's happening in West Asia. There's a lot of interesting things happening. Your publication also talks about the new year, 2023. You have some of your columnists and your contributors making predictions, making some analysis. So we can start wherever you want. I can suggest, if you like, with your permission, we start with the very interesting article that you had in your publication related to the way in which the Americans are basically blackmailing Iraq, because in terms of the money that they, the oil money, the oil sales money that the Iraqis have to send to the U.S., and that the U.S. is basically, you know, blackmailing the Iraqis. If you could give us a little insight into that story, and we can start there and go to other places later.
Well, you know, there are quite a few countries in the region now that are experiencing severe economic downturns. And right. Some of these are natural because governments have not planned ahead. Governments borrow money excessively, whether for the IMF or allies in the region and abroad. And they don't really have programs. There's a lot of corruption. So, but what's happening recently, I think in the last few years, is an escalation of the sanctions tool, the U.S. sanctions tool,
right,
to bring even allies into line mm-hmm. with U.S. Policy ambitions in the region. And the most recent, I mean, Turkey's experienced this, for instance, a NATO
Correct.
Ally.
Correct.
But most recently, we're seeing this in Iraq. And what happened recently is that about 19 Iraqi banks were sanctioned. That decreased the central bank sales of dollars by about 40%,
mm-hmm.
which led to a huge decline in supply
mm-hmm.
And a huge decline in the ability for banks to transfer dollars. You would have to wait a minimum of 15 days now to transfer dollars anywhere. Part of this was to get a handle on the dollars that were moving in the Iraqi market, particularly outside of Iraq, to countries like Iran, mm-hmm. Syria, and Lebanon. So
right.
these particular screws that were put on Iraq specify Lebanon as one of those target countries
right.
where dollars are being contained. But I think, you know, this article that we wrote was, it went viral. I think even Iraqi journalists, we don't see a lot of light shining on
That's right.
issues that are of huge importance to the economic independence and political independence of the country. Seems like Iraqi politicians themselves, no matter what side, do not want to discuss the nitty-gritty. And an example of this is that our article shines a light on the fact that since 2003, the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq,
mm-hmm.
All Iraqi oil revenues
mm-hmm.
must be sent to a single bank account in the United States, okay? Not multiple, not dollar accounts in Singapore or in Europe or anywhere. One single bank account in the United States. This is by the occupying and invading entity.
Right.
And all these years later, exactly 20 years later, this practice continues. And this is a key point of leverage that the Americans continue to exercise over all Iraqi political decisions. If you don't do this, we will not release your oil revenue dollar supply in our bank, right?
Right.
But this is something like you're hard-pressed to find Iraqi politicians, again, on both sides of the political aisle or all sides of the political spectrum to address this very critical issue. How can Iraq use its dollars, use its oil revenues to invest in infrastructure, key infrastructure that is severely affecting the population, like access to water, electricity, et cetera. You know, we've seen protests about these kind of things. How can they do that when they don't control their That's revenues? Right. So I think this is a very important thing, and we hope in the next few weeks and months to delve deeper into the subject and try to get Iraqi politicians on the record about, and this issue on the table in Iraq. You know, why is our money there, and how do we diversify it so that we have Right. control over our revenues?
That's very interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, everybody probably remembers that during the sanctions before the American invasion, there was the famous oil for food program, mm-hmm. which, you know, didn't really do much for the Iraqis even at that time. But it seems that this is just a continuation of that. And then, of course, we have that famous photograph of Senator Tom Cotton, who was a an American officer in the Iraq War, sitting on this pile of gold bars from the Iraqi Central Bank, which apparently, this was reported at that time. I haven't seen any reporting after that. But at that time, it was reported that basically all the gold reserves were shipped off to Canada after the invasion. So it seems that, you know, this whole occupation that the Americans had was very much that old school mercantilist, you know, colonialist, imperialist strategy: get the oil, get the gold, and not really caring about other things. And so it seems that maybe Iraq, until this is solved, until this is resolved in some way, is not going to be able to be a normal country and deal with other countries, as we've seen, for example, with some of the cases that it had with Iran. Is there anything else you might want to add to that?
Do you know, I think what's happening is very critical here, because, I mean, this has been going on for absolute decades. It's not a recent thing, but right. There has always been Western efforts to shutter the borders between Iran and Iraq, between Iraq and Syria,
that's right.
Between Syria and Lebanon. And that continues. I mean, you actually have U.S. troops stationed at the Syrian-Iraqi border to
exactly.
inhibit the flow of goods and, transportation vehicles and whatever for the last number of years.
We just had that recent attack on the Iranian convoy
yeah.
that was sending, you know, diapers
yeah.
and the gloves, the sanitary gloves.
Yes. And, you know, we have a new Iraqi prime minister, Prime Minister Sudani, and he comes in as a nominee of the more pro-Iran elements
right.
Of the Iraqi body politic. And so he's an unknown factor. The previous prime minister, Mustafa al-Kazemi,
right.
was pretty much, you know, towed the American line on all things. Prior to him, you had Adel Abdel Mahdi.
Right.
And he was very interesting because he was doing some unusual things in Iraq. Just before the October protests broke out in 2019
yes.
and basically, scuttled all political movement, development, economic, political,
right.
you know,
yes.
movements, et cetera. And one of the things he did was open officially
mm-hmm.
the Iraqi-Syrian border.
That's right.
The other thing he did was he signed an agreement with the Chinese, basically an oil for infrastructure
right.
deal, and a couple of other things like that within a short space of time, which absolutely, raised all kinds of alarms for the Americans.
Right.
And then within no time, you had the October protests. And this is how they do. They can create domestic strife in countries. They can sanction entities. They can use financial tools to destabilize the national currency.
Right.
They can set off a fire or a bomb here and there. But to me, it seems that these are the only tools left in the U.S. policy toolbox. They
right.
are not going to engage in a war or fan the flames towards a war because they cannot afford this. Their sights are firmly set on the Russian theater.
Right.
With the Chinese one not far behind. I mean, many American policymakers argue that China's number one. Why are we wasting our time on Russia? And then there are those who take a flip view. But for right now, West Asia can pretty much assure itself that there's not going to be any major hot war in the region. But we are going to have plenty of troubling instigations, sabotage,
right.
Efforts to buy off people and to sway perceptions, that kind of thing, you know. But the toolbox is very small these days for the Americans. But I think Iraq is a perfect example of a recently targeted state, and it comes as a warning to Sudani, who, as I said, was it was a nominee from the sort of a pro-Iran coalition in Iraq,
sure.
to not rock the boat too much, and you know. Sure enough, Sudani made a statement about a week or two ago saying he's not troubled by U.S. troops stationed in the country, et
right.
cetera, which I didn't take very seriously because his role ultimately is to balance Iran and the U.S. which is unfortunate because an Iraqi prime minister's role should not be to balance these two countries.
Right, exactly.
It should be to pave a pathway for Iraq's economic development. You know, and
yeah, what are Iraq's national interests? That should be the focus.
I mean, in Iraq, in Lebanon, they're treading water.
Right.
And I mean, there's a point to that. You know, I don't particularly think much of the slow bloodletting that happens. You know,
right.
These sanctions on Syria are absolutely oppressive, on Iran, now on Iraq, on Turkey, Egypt's economy. Why are we all treading water instead of carving a new path together?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because it seems to me that what you're talking about is really a problem of the elites of those countries, not having the power to be able to define their own national interests. You know, of course, Iran, the big exception in this case, you know, having a revolution, having an independent system of governance, no matter what one might want to criticize, and there are things to criticize about Iran, but it is an independent country. It makes its own decisions based on its national interests. So you mentioned Egypt. There's a lot to talk about Iraq. We could go on for the whole program. So let's move to Egypt. You were talking about how, a lot of the economies in the region are experiencing problems. And, of course, Egypt is maybe, you know, experiencing the worst economic crisis, in a very long time. There was this very secret, under the radar, your publication reported about it, this very secretive, under the radar summit of leaders of some Arab countries in the Emirates, of course, without the presence of the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. And it seems the King of Jordan was there, the Egyptian leadership was there, and it seems that the main focus was trying to basically, you know, save Egypt from this social economic catastrophe that's looming there. If you could please, you know, share some insight into this issue with us.
Well, the columnist Abdel Bari Atwan, who wrote that
very
piece,
famous columnist.
He's wonderful. He didn't know the answers to why there was an emergency summit called for the next day,
right,
that required the attendance of heads of states, not only heads of states of Egypt and Jordan, but of four of the GCC countries. So he had to analyze what potentially was the subject under discussion and came up with two things. One was, King Abdullah flew over,
right,
and suddenly you had this meeting. So what that could suggest, for instance, is because in Egypt the previous day, the meeting was included the Palestinian head of state. King Abdullah had been...
Right, King Abdullah of Jordan.
King Abdullah of Jordan had been attending,
right,
a meeting that included Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
Correct.
And we know recently there has been a lot of concern about the status of Jerusalem and the new right-wing Israeli government's,
that's right,
efforts to depopulate Jerusalem of Palestinian residents and to also, you know, attack Al-Aqsa Mosque and potentially destroy it. So, and King Abdullah of Jordan has voiced significant concern because he is viewed as the custodian of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem.
Right.
And fears that status is about to be taken out from under him. So that was one potential topic of discussion. And the other one was Egypt's economy. I mean, we're talking about the entire collapse of the state, the inability for Egypt to address the most basic services,
right,
in its country. And the IMF has said that Egypt needs $40 billion in immediate aid. Otherwise, the state's collapse is imminent and inevitable. So,
right,
traditionally, Egypt, I think since the beginning of the Arab Spring, has taken in financial assistance from Persian Gulf countries to a much larger amount than $40 billion. But Persian Gulf countries recently, and perhaps this is why the Saudis and Kuwaitis didn't attend, the Kuwaiti parliament took a decision not to give Egypt any more aid. And the Saudis have now announced, I think we heard at Davos recently, that there will be no unconditional aid anymore,
mm-hmm,
to anyone, okay?
Right.
So I think these were two potential topics under discussion at the secretive meeting in Abu Dhabi. But, you know, I don't